For those who don't know, I'm Brent Lofgren. I'm from the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And today I'm going to talk about, part of it will be some previous research that I've worked on in a large group, and you'll see a list of most of that group of people. I have a little bit less of prepared material than I did yesterday. Some of it is more in the form of a travelogue. So you'll see Kenya, Tanzania, and China in here. And then once I'm finished, we'll probably have some time for discussion, and maybe we can talk a little more about uncertainty issues that were brought up before, or whatever you want to talk about. So, anyone want to throw out some dates? For this one, there's kind of not a particular right answer to this, but...
It was stuff in the 60s.
I thought I heard about it first in the 70s.
All right, well... Who's the oldest person here?
Well, I'm 94.
Are you this old?
I'm 107.
I'm a young guy. You're a young 107.
Right. 1996.
Oh, wow.
Are you that old? And this, yeah, this really isn't even the very oldest. So
sure.
Svante Arrhenius was a quite famous at that time Swedish chemist. And he did some calculations about how much long-wave radiation would be absorbed by carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and did some calculations about how much coal they were burning back then. Pretty much it was all coal at that time. And found a little bit of warming, and it didn't seem like all that much. And then this is what I mentioned yesterday. Manabe and Weatherall did it on a computer and included the feedback due to increased water vapor in the atmosphere that would accompany this warming. So that's a positive feedback. It's a multiplying factor. And they found a much more significant warming. And in that case, they treated the entire atmosphere as just one column of air. So the worldwide atmosphere is represented as just one column. And then kind of the next big modeling study was 1975, and that's where they divided the whole world into smaller pieces and incorporated the whole circulation of the atmosphere into the calculations. All right, so this is what we called the CLIP project. Now I'm trying to remember. It originated in 2003 and really ran through about 2007. And I'm trying to remember what the acronym was. It was Climate Land Interaction Project East Africa. And what it did was it looked to some extent at the effect of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases on East Africa, but it also really, its main purpose was looking at the effects of land use in East Africa on the local climate. So that means deforestation, cutting down trees. What does that do with the way the sun interacts with the surface, and how the surface is exchanging heat with the atmosphere above, and what that does to the circulation of the atmosphere? It can feed back into precipitation, temperature, winds, all of those things. So it was really centered at Michigan State University. That's the longest list of people. We got a lot of support from International Livestock Research Institute in Nairobi, which is kind of an interesting place to visit. It's an island of middle class people in a sea of poverty, really. Okay, I thought my space bar would work for this. And this is just kind of a conceptual diagram of what we did. So this gives you some idea of, this is actually a little bit like, for those who were here yesterday, not quite as spaghetti of a diagram, but it shows some of those interactions that I showed yesterday between the atmosphere and the surface. And in this case, it really includes humans as well. So the way that humans are incorporated, NPP stands for net primary productivity. That's really the amount of agricultural production that's going on in this area. So that's what supports humans, and humans are driven to change the way that they're using the land. And that's really shown in the photograph here. Now, for those who are a little bit familiar, these people are wearing Maasai costumes. And they are Maasai, but they're not acting like it. They're growing plants. And I've heard that some Maasai are so strict that kind of the modern way of building one of their huts, the old way is to build this dome of mud and dung. The more modern way is to put up a big center pole and have a thatched roof on it. And one of the main advantages of that is it ventilates the smoke out of the house. Rather than having a solid dome, you've got a thatched roof that can filter out the smoke. But in putting up that center post, the really strict ones have to hire someone else to do it because they refuse to dig in the dirt. So agriculture is a big step for them to do. They herd animals. So the atmospheric modeling part of this, in concept, this is like one of the global climate models that we were talking about, but it's centering in on a smaller region. And it's actually a telescoping region. We've got this outside area, the whole area that's shown there, divided into 64-kilometer size boxes. And then the smaller area on the inside is divided into 16 kilometers. Yeah, and this is just showing kind of how well the temperature matches up with reality, and it's really far from perfect.
So which is you're saying modeling compared with?
Yeah, the model results are on the left. Okay. So that's a map of the temperature in the region we're looking at, and on the right is an observed data set. So yeah, that's the average temperature for 1 month.
I'm not getting it if Celsius is going above, I mean, up to 280.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There should be a decimal point in each of those. Yeah.
20.2.
Yeah. See, it's just barely showing up. That's the decimal point right there.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. I can't see it from here.
Then it was extended to look at agricultural productivity. And these are a couple of British people, Phil Thornton and Ruth Docherty. They had the expertise in that sort of area. And Phil Thornton actually kind of moved back and forth between Scotland and Kenya. So this is a picture of some other people I met over there. I'll explain. I first really got interested in East Africa by being in this research project. But then following that, I got interested in projects that my church was doing. So I've been to Kenya 3 times. Those were all work trips. I've been to Tanzania 4 times. And 3 of those were with the church group, and 1 was work. And this is actually kind of a worst case effect on maize production. So what it's representing is, and it doesn't have actual numbers on what the yields are. It's just lowest to highest that they've ever seen, go from one up to zero. And within the historical climate, it's got this peak right in here. And what they're depicting here is threshold yield is, if it goes below that, they can't really sustain production at that location. So in the historical climate, it's very rare to have it down in here. In this particular worst case that they kind of picked out, there's a large increase in the number of yields that fall below the threshold. And then I'm going to mostly skip over this. What the matrix on the left is showing is the way that they weighted all these input factors based on advice by a bunch of experts. They said, well, what would people do if they were subjected to yields below some threshold and had income at or below some threshold? Would they move away? And kind of the bottom line is shown in the bottom left. They ran this model for several years and found that people are doing sort of okay, the positive bars, and it's time going to the right. They're doing okay for the first little while, and then they have a couple of really bad years, and it goes negative and stays there, maybe kind of gradually recovers, but not a very good situation as simulated by this model.
Is this for the countries you're talking about, Tanzania, or is it all of Africa?
Yeah, this what's shown there is really just one sort of representative location within those countries. Mm-hmm. And a little later I'm going to be showing you a map of the overall projected maize yield for that whole area. And another one of the inputs into this is land use. So, we don't really have a key for what the use types are here, but the red has the arrows pointing at it. That's Nairobi. And so red means an urban area. And these are three different data sets that you can use as land use input to a model. And they define their classes of land use kind of differently. It's the purple that's cultivated agriculture, and the yellows are kind of more mixed grassland and rangeland. And one of the things that's kind of interesting over there is, to a Westerner's eye, you can go up on one of these hills and look out, and it just looks like a bunch of trees. But in the meantime, there are thousands upon thousands of people living within that area that you're looking at, and they're grazing a lot of cattle in that area. It's kind of unexpected. And how many people have been in East Africa? Yeah. So, country roads, you just see all sorts of people walking along them, very un-American. It's many aspects of life over there are very different. Yes,
Paul? Are these three different model projections, or the actual, and are they, it looks like the same area, why are they different?
Yeah, they're not quite the same area. This one, for some reason, doesn't go quite as far east. So this circle right here Anyone know what it is?
Kilimanjaro.
That's Kilimanjaro, yeah. So that's kind of missing from this one. But the reason, one of the reasons why they look different is that they are allegedly observations, but people have used different classification schemes to put them into and kind of gone out and judged what those areas are, possibly differently, and have had updates at different times. Yeah, there are a lot of things, and one of the things that struck me too, this is called Lake Natron. That's just on the Kenyan side, and it's a different shape in each in each diagram. So this is one of the difficulties that we deal with. You know, which of those do you believe? And then in this experiment, this was used as sort of a starting point. And then there was yet another model that was used to project into the future what this land use would be.
Brett, just a question. Were the readings taken by satellite, or were they taken by, what method were the readings taken by?
Yeah, for those land use classes, I can't go over all the sources that they use, but mostly it's just ground-based observation.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So here's a Maasai festival. Shirehe. That word just popped into my mind. That's what they call a big party like this. And they jump really high. So kind of the bottom line result of this, which doesn't really give you all the news, and I'm sorry that sort of the international boundaries aren't really showing up on this, but we looked at the effects of greenhouse gases alone on the top, land cover, land use change effects alone in the middle, and then combined effects on the bottom. So the red, yellow, and orange are decreases in the maize yield in those areas, and increases are shown in green, and it's really a mixture of results depending on region.
Excuse me, the upper body of water be by any chance be Lake Victoria?
Yeah, the water body in the middle is Lake Victoria, the big round one, and that's the area of confluence of the countries of Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda.
Yeah.
Okay, so Tanzania roughly goes like that. Kenya is here, and Uganda is over here. And Rwanda and Burundi are kind of on the northern edge of that. But you can see some patterns to it. You've got this land use change, and you've got an increase in maize yields right along the coastline, and that's reflective of reduced evaporation. It's one of the main changes in land use that is projected in that area is removal of mangrove forests, and mangroves grow along coastlines because they thrive in salt water. So if they've got their roots in some salt water, they do well. It's questionable whether you can have much agriculture in those areas. Some of those areas have been used for rice. And one of the things that my colleague Nathan Moore points out is a whole lot of these green areas, I'll point out that maize is primarily used as a subsistence crop. So people grow it, they eat it. And ugali is one of their staple foods. That's corn porridge. And so that's really grown all over. But a lot of the more wealthy producers are often in those green areas, and they'll produce more cash crop items, and a lot of them, a lot of those areas are owned by foreigners and done on sort of a sharecrop basis. So they'll grow coffee and roses. A lot of the cut flowers in the world are grown in Kenya. Pineapples are big there. A wide variety of crops.
So what you're saying is that the areas where they might increase productivity are areas that may not go into local subsistence.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'll sort of inject. I showed that picture of those Maasai guys and at the beginning standing in their field, and I should have pointed out that's tomatoes in that field. There's corn in the background. So there's that sort of conversion, and they're hoping to make a better living by doing that. And that was actually located on the lower slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro on the Kenyan side. And that's an area where they're able to get some water for irrigation. But one of the things that's happening is certain tribes are herding tribes and others are farming tribes. And they each want the land for their own purposes, and there's difficulty with really establishing ownership of land, too. One of the anecdotes I heard is that the Maasai are particularly lacking in respect for land ownership, and they had a drought and would bring their cattle right into the middle of Nairobi and graze on people's lawns in town and insist, you're not using it for anything, so why can't I graze my cattle there?
I think you mentioned it, and I didn't hear it, but this increase decreases over what amount of time?
Oh, yeah, sorry. This is roughly 50 years. Yeah, this is a mid-21st century projection.
Well, we were up by Lake Victoria, and we were struck by the difference between the Luo tribe area and the Maasai tribe area. Mm-hmm. The Maasai tribe was fertile, and trees and grass and things like that, and the Luo had a lot of wild goats that were just decimating the place. It was just dirt.
Okay. I'm a little surprised that the Maasai area was not somewhat the same way.
In that area near Kisumu.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because there didn't seem to be any husbandry concern in the Luo area. They were just, they said, okay, dirt.
Yeah, you know whose tribe that is.
No.
That's Barack Obama's tribe.
It is.
The Luo, yes.
And years ago, they said there'd be a Luo president of the United States before a president of Kenya. And that was way before Barack Obama, but that was a saying with the Luo.
Ah, okay.
And they were right.
All right, so this is just kind of my summary of East Africa. Changes in maize yield are a mixed bag, and that was kind of the yardstick that we were using for overall agricultural yield. And I should point out on that scale of uncertainty that we talked about, I would say that the particular results that we showed here are quite far up on the scale of uncertainty, especially when you really look at the details. So what we really learned from this is that we can expect highly variable impacts by location. And, you know, we I'd say it's difficult to trust the exact locations where we're showing increases and decreases, but the changes are very likely to be variable by location. And where yields are improved, they're often growing some of these other crops. And when we talk about the people who are less fortunate, these are the less fortunate people, and that also means they're the most vulnerable, so they're prone to becoming even more unfortunate. So these people are very vulnerable, results are uncertain, and competition for land and other resources is intense. And I put solutions question mark at the bottom. One of the things with competition for land and other resources that is tough to impose on people is controlling their population. So I don't know if anyone wants to come up with, throw out any other solutions.
Well, education reduces.
Education, yeah.
Deal with especially for females.
Mm-hmm. What areas are we seeing in the news where the drought is so terrifically devastating?
Texas.
in the Sahel of Africa, isn't it?
Yeah. Sahel in Western Africa has had really a very strong history of droughts over the last few decades. That's a change over, well, really that I think started making news in the early 70s or so. And it's variable year by year, but the Sahel area was one of the places that really brought this land use change idea into currency as something that causes changes in climate. So if it causes changes in climate, that can affect the vegetation that's there. So that's a land use change, and it'll feed back and cause further changes in climate. So it's something that can sort of snowball on itself depending upon where you're looking at. Yeah, Paul.
It's interesting that if biofuels continue to be used, that's questionable, of course, but if biofuels continue to be used, then maize would become a cash crop, but the price would go up, so the people still would not be able to probably afford to buy their own maize for their own consumption.
Like yeah. Mexico.
Yeah. Well, they might get more transportation infrastructure in this area if they were to find that maize was a good cash crop. But then again, it's likely to be capitalists that are taking over and controlling that whole production and transportation of it. Yeah.
Two questions. Do the farmers that plant maize, do they own their own land? And number two, do they keep planting maize year after year after year, or is there any crop rotation in that aspect?
In a lot of places, they really do keep planting it year after year and without fertilizer, really of any kind.
Well, it's a depletion in the yield then.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a lot of cases, their population is quite mobile. They build their houses out of corrugated metal, and you know, just tiny little houses. So they'll leave it and go and start farming some other land.
Do they own it or not?
Quickly, I think that's really a mixture.
Okay,
and that's what leads to conflict.
Does the entire family work in the field, or is it just the man or the woman? Or
I'm more familiar with how the Maasai do it. And
yeah, other parts it's mainly the women who do the farming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was going to say that.
Excuse me for interrupting you.
I was going to say about the Maasai that it tends a lot to be the children actually out herding the animals, and the women working hard at the house, and the men drinking and playing games.
They can't kill lions anymore.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah, don't change it.
Yeah, John.
Are there other areas of the world that share pretty much similar, at least, characteristics as this one does, that where they're working on solutions and something's happening there that can be transported to this area?
So solutions that can be...
Yeah, are there other areas of the world that share the characteristics of deterioration of productivity for agricultural crops and problems for local peoples, like the area that you've shown us, that can be seen where they're tackling the same problems, so that there's some sort of laboratories around the world?
Yeah, I can't really think of an answer to that. Some of my colleagues on that list might be better at that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think maybe the solution, at least from my perspective, would be that, you know, kind of keep up. There's nothing to do about the land use patterns and the changes in land use in an area other than our own. But we can do something, and I think there's a solution. We can do something about our own contributions to the problem of things like greenhouse gas and climate change. It seems to me as though that's really what we ought to be focused on. We can certainly keep an eye on what's going on. Other folks use that as a way to build some empathy and concern, but I think we need to take responsibility for how we're best in the place. So.
Yeah. Yeah. The greenhouse gases are one of the factors that we've got in there. I'll mention that there really is a faction of scientists who very strongly state that the emphasis on the effects of greenhouse gases is out of proportion to the effects of land use change, and that's valid both in the U.S., in the developed world, and in the developing world.
But land use change isn't the only effect of climate change. I mean, there's species extinction and ocean acidification and all kinds of other things that come.
Okay, ocean acidification is a result of CO2 concentration. It's not a result of climate change.
No, I didn't mean it's a result. It's a corollary of the CO2 being added to the atmosphere.
Yeah, okay. So what this group is saying, and I'm somewhat in support of what they say, but definitely not as vehement about it. But what they're saying is that the part that is due to greenhouse gases, part of climate change that is due to greenhouse gases, has been strongly emphasized and has neglected the accompanying effects of changes in land use.
That's true, but we can only do things about land use that we ourselves can control. I mean, we ought to be doing that.
Yeah.
But it seems to me as though we have a responsibility to our worldwide community to be doing stuff on the other front as well. And that's one of the things that's really disturbing about the whole issue of climate change and our inability to really get ourselves into a place where we're going to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we find ourselves hit with a problem that we haven't, you know, that we're helping to create, we tend to sort of shy away from it and look for a solution someplace else. And that's what we do as critics. And I think that ultimately the solution is us taking collective responsibility, individual.
I'd say furthermore, the land use change effects are more localized in comparison to the CO2 effects. So therefore, one of the goals of this project was to inform the officials and people of these countries about some of the problems that they might face. And it seems like they've really taken an interest and picked up on it. And yeah, at the same time, there's the CO2 effect. And actually, as I showed yesterday, and this is really only one model's opinion in this particular area, it's projecting strong increases in soil moisture as a result of climate change. And again, I'd emphasize that this is way out on the uncertain edge of results, and it's really only one projection's opinion.
That's if they don't wash the people away.
Aren't they also predicting that the snows on Kilimanjaro are going to go into, they're not, it's not going to be snow covered all year?
Yeah, and the state.
And that'll affect what water's available for people.
Yeah, actually the expert opinion on what's already happened on Kilimanjaro is that it's been reduced precipitation that has caused reduced snowpack on Kilimanjaro more so than warming.
Okay, but reduced precipitation could be part of all the changes that come.
Right. Indeed it could. And again, that's out on the edges of uncertainty, so it could. And I don't think anyone has established that it is a result. Sandy, you had your
Well, it seems like, you know, it's terrifically complex, but there's how are people prioritizing what can actually be done? And I think, David, you said education. Well, how people from outside of Africa can be educated to see how they're contributing to lack of health for the people who live there. And then I'm just going to ask her, are there leaders among the people, like among the Maasai or others, who are open-minded or interested in understanding some of the agricultural methods or so that can be done? Is there evidence that there are people who will be open to that?
Yeah, I don't know what this guy's title was, but in that first picture that I showed with the tomato field and those guys there, they've got sort of a regional leader whose name is Tony Mepikori, and he actually used to be a field assistant for the head of this whole project. So he was our host on that visit and showed us around these areas and had us sit and talk to some of the elders there. And one of the things, even though it was a very secular type of meeting, we opened with prayer. That's something that they insist on. And we, it was the fig tree. Mm-hmm. They said, go to this town, meet under the fig tree. So that's where we sat, and we also learned that it was these five old, very old men, and they had each walked for at least 5 miles, 10 miles, maybe some of them even more, and there was some sort of mix-up in the communication, and they had shown up like a week before we were actually there. So they walked in and we weren't there, and they walked back. And then we came again and waited under the fig tree, and finally they got there. Yeah.
I think one of the problems with that whole area that we observed was that many of the little villages, Obinji was one that we visited, have no support from any central government. And so they are survival villages. And it's very hard to convince them that rotating crops is a wise idea when the only food they've got is the corn that they raise. Mm-hmm. And it's everything they've got there seems to be, Kenya. They, at the time we visited there, they were spending of the order of 97 cents per year per person in Kenya on medical care. 96 cents per year was spent for the government officials in Nairobi. And outside, it was almost nothing. And our daughter was doing a research project, the interaction between native medicine and Western medicine. And the conclusion they came to, and there was a very, very caring professor at the university who was in charge of this, was to teach the healthcare folks out in the bush how to set arms and legs that got broken, because they did not know how to do that, and so the kid would grow up with an arm like that or a leg that was permanently crippled, and they found that, you put some sticks there and tie some twine around it and it heals better, and so the sense that we have is that the administration, the government, has a responsibility to everyone, hasn't yet been adopted by some of these communities.
Yeah. And I was thinking about your team that it may, hopefully in small part, your team might be a representation of somebody who has some care for the welfare. Mm-hmm. And so that these people would gather under the fig tree because there would be some sense of trust. And oh my, how seems to me how long it would take to bring people in who would have a way of showing that, well, we do want to have some ideas to help you. Mm-hmm. Do you think they were listening to you with that openness?
They have experience with a number of research teams from other countries and humanitarian groups, and they positively receive that sort of people. Unfortunately, it's really tough to make very authoritative conclusions out of this sort of study. But sort of one of the rival research results did the same sort of thing at a much coarser resolution and just said agriculture in East Africa is a wash over time. It's pretty much neutral, no change. But on the ground, there's certain to be a whole lot of change in the way individual people live. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I have less really prepared for China. I'm just going to show some pictures of how guests from scientists from the U.S. eat there. And some of the type of agriculture that they have there. It seems that China is changing very rapidly, but their food production is not really keeping up in its technology with the rest of the country. So this is a temple on the hillside in Lanzhou, China. Any Augies in the audience? Okay, I'm wearing my Augie shirt. This is the research group that we were meeting with from Lanzhou University. Just to my left in the picture is Chen Cheng-he, and he is his main job is professor at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he also has an adjunct professorship at Lanzhou University in China, and To my right in that picture is Carlo DeMarchi, who is a colleague that I've worked with from Case Western Reserve University, originally from Italy. And this is some of the fields that we saw, and actually those hills behind kind of give the appearance of being man-made terraced, if you imagine it, but in actuality they're not. That's just strata of rock. So they've just got a little bit of space next to the road to grow some crops there, and it's a very dry area, and the amount of space that they've got for growing in this particular location is not very amenable to automated production, so it's really done by hand. They don't even have draft animals for the most part. They're tilling it by human power.
What part of China is this?
This is kind of north central. It's a semi-arid area. It's getting in toward the Gobi Desert. And it's right on the Yellow River. That temple that you saw right away is right next to the Yellow River in Lanzhou. And this is an artificial reservoir. A little ways out of town, and this is part of the Yellow River system, and they've through various natural and human regulated processes, they've lowered and raised the water levels there quite a bit and washed out the soil around the roots of these trees, and you can see the haze in the air too.
How was this area chosen for the study? Or,
well, this isn't really a study. This was a trip that I took over there to give some advice to this research group. So the university there is their location.
And it's a research on climate change is affecting agriculture?
Yeah, what they're really looking at is how climate change is affecting the whole water budget of all their systems. And they are going to be looking at agriculture as part of that, but also flow in these rivers and how they might regulate reservoirs like this.
Is the haze from air pollution in general?
Yeah. And at this location, it at least gives the appearance of being well outside of any urban area. Mm. Although one of the things that surprised me was along one side of this reservoir, they're building a new very large highway that to me appeared to be going nowhere, and a very large bridge is part of that. But I don't know the area all that well, so not sure just what they're going for. But then one of their sort of tourist-oriented features, they did have a farm restaurant that they bragged about their organic production there, where, I think a lot of the production technically is organic, but that means that they're not doing anything. They're depleting the soil. But here's what they serve to visiting foreigners. Lots of fresh fruit and vegetables. And it was very tasty. And just a whole lot of food. I ate really well for a whole week while I was over there. And one of the things that surprised me a little bit, I guess maybe they considered it to be too pedestrian to serve to people visiting, but I expected to eat a lot more rice than I did. But they've got a lot of fruit that we eat, and this is the tea that I had over there. They have a tradition in this particular area. There's a date in there and another thing they call wolfberry, and I've forgotten what the other one is, along with their green tea. And then if you want your food staring back at you.
So what is it?
So you can see that it's a, there's a, yeah, it's a chicken with the head still on the plate.
The comb.
There we go. The eyes of China.
At least it's not a dog.
So at least one of the advantages of China is they've really gotten serious about keeping their population under control. Seems like they're headed toward this sort of inverted age demographic issue, with a whole lot more retired people than younger people, which is a little worrisome. And there's among the more educated people, there's this whole issue of people emigrating from China, and it seems like more and more of them are going back to China as well. So one example of sort of partially doing that is my colleague Chan Sheng-he, who spends about half his year in China after moving to the U.S. Something like 25 years ago. And this is just kind of a tourist site, and actually I was breaking the rules by taking this picture because I didn't interpret one word that they had in English the same way that they did. This is called the Bingling Grottoes, and it's a whole series of Buddha sculptures put in these niches in the rock, and several of the others that were kind of earlier along the pathway was a much deeper indentation into the rock, and they said, don't take pictures of the caves. So when I saw something that was, you know, like 6 or 8 feet deep, I said, okay, that's a cave, I better not take a picture of it. Then when I saw this, that's probably less than a foot deep, I said, that's not a cave, that's just like a little niche in the wall. So I did take that picture. And then the next one is just kind of a neat picture of a, happened to catch the pigeon flying out of that hole in the wall. Was actually, it was put there to put a wooden beam in there to support an awning over the carvings in the wall. But they no longer had that awning, and a lot of the carvings had screen doors that would close over them to keep the pigeons and so forth from getting in there. So, any questions, discussion?
The universities over there, do they teach, you know, husbandry or enhancing growth? I guess what I'm wondering is there an indigenous effort to better things?
Yeah, I don't think there is much of that at this particular university. The different universities kind of have specialized purposes. So this was really the geography department at Lanzhou University, and I guess I don't really know enough to answer that question in general, but my understanding is they really look down on farmers and have difficulty taking it seriously as something that they should grow as part of their economy.
Another question, in terms of climate change, how much of the developed part of China is at danger of, say, a 5 meter rise in sea level?
Yeah, well, Hong Kong is the area that has been developed by Western economies traditionally, and they are definitely in danger, and a whole lot of the
populated
cities are, Shanghai, Guangzhou. Yeah, and yeah, I can't even name all the cities. And yeah, you have to know a lot about Chinese geography and who's living where, and it's changing very rapidly. I didn't show any of the pictures of construction, but the construction pace over there is just unbelievable to me, and they said it's really slowed down in the last 5 years. Yeah, Maury.
Yeah, you're employed by NOAA, National.
Yes.
Remind me what that all stands for.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
I appreciate you comment on the mission of NOAA. Here we're talking about Africa, and we're talking about mm-hmm. China, and how the mission of NOAA is defined that takes you to these places.
Yeah. So in the definition of our mission, it's the study of atmospheres and oceans, to some extent worldwide, and these particular projects. One of the things that you really need in order to justify it is a funding source that's external to the base funding of NOAA. So the all of the African research was funded by National Science Foundation. At least the part that I participated in, I believe there was some United Nations funding that went to some of the other participants. That's part of the game that all of these researchers play, especially at the universities, but to some extent at government agencies too. If you want to do something outside of the particular aim of your home office, you need to get external funding. This China trip was really a limited commitment, and they paid for my travel over there and a little bit of my time. So that was much less involved, but they paid for it. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to me, with all of the potential issues and real issues now in the agricultural production in countries that aren't as advanced as the Western world is, could certainly call for more Norman Borlaug kind of initiatives, where India virtually was saved mm-hmm. to become, at least at the time, food self-sufficient. Is there any echo of anything like that being initiated by the U.S. Agriculture Department or United Nations associated countries?
I would say that one thing that pops into my mind is the International Livestock Research Institute in Nairobi that I mentioned, and that's a UN-supported organization, and they do the grants game that I was just talking about. They look at all sorts of they can get funding from a much wider variety of potential sources than I can. A lot of private foundations, Rockefeller Foundation, for example. Can fund them for special projects and particular projects that they propose to do. They can get funding through UN or from various individual countries. So another project that I'll mention, that I'm not actually doing the research, but I was asked a few years ago to serve on a review panel for a consortium of German and Tanzanian universities to study interactions between climate and ecosystems on Mount Kilimanjaro. So they're looking at a pretty limited area, but have a big research team, and they were funded to the tune of about 20 million euros to have a big research team for 3 years. We're at our time here, but those who want to stay and talk with me are welcome to.
Thank you.